From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, how to hide $1 trillion. William Britton Catlin tells us about offshore corporate shelters. He says giant companies hide their profits in financial centers like the Cayman Islands, away from the eyes of investors, regulators, and tax collectors. As much as a third of the world's wealth, he says, is held offshore. Also, the tricky part, one boy's fall from trespass into grace. Martin Moran tells his story of adolescent sexual abuse at the hands of a former counselor at a Catholic boys' camp. Moran created a one-man show out of his experiences, and he's just published the story in book form. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. By one estimate, $800 million in U.S. banking deposits are sitting in tax-exempt accounts registered in the Cayman Islands in the Caribbean. My guest, William Britton Catlin, explores the use of offshore tax shelters and shell corporations in his new book, Offshore: The Dark Side of the Global Economy. The Cayman Islands are one of many offshore jurisdictions around the world whose laws allow companies and people to set up accounts and corporate subsidiaries that are free from taxation and regulatory scrutiny. That kind of secrecy has served as a cover for fraud and money laundering for decades. And though reforms are in the works, offshore tax shelters are still being used by almost every major company in the world. William Britton Catlin is a producer for the BBC. He said he got interested in the offshore economy when he was working as an investigator for Kroll Associates, an international security firm.
Kroll is a private investigations company, and I worked for their London office. And I was working there in the kind of boom period of the economy at the end of the 1990s. And I would be working for clients who were involved in deals with counterparties in Russia, American clients who'd be doing business in Russia or South Africa or Israel or anywhere like that. And it would very soon become apparent that the people you were looking at, their business that you were looking at, would be held together at the end, the bottom, by an offshore company. And this happened time and time again. It seemed to me that this was absolutely key to the way that modern business was actually being done on the ground. I would encounter these offshore companies all the time, and they would be frustrating as an investigator because you couldn't get behind them because of the secrecy aspect. And at the same time, they were quite seductive, these entities, these offshore entities, because there was a kind of mystique around them. There they were, and you couldn't do anything about them. They kind of stood apart from the normal realm of life.
Now, as you studied the offshore world, I mean, your book deals in large part with the Cayman Islands, which a lot of people know is one of the most famous offshore tax havens. Give us a sense of how this island in the Caribbean became a tax haven. You know, what kind of transformation it underwent?
It underwent an absolutely total transformation. I mean, here you had an island where they fished for turtles in the sea. They made fishing nets. And really, that was about it. And the menfolk used to work on the oil tankers taking up oil across to North America. Now, imagine that. That was a small, pretty undeveloped country only about less than 50 years ago. And now it's the fifth largest financial center in the world with all the major banks, all the major financial institutions there, and all the main corporations, all the American multinationals, having subsidiaries there. I mean, that's a huge change.
So what drove the transformation of the Cayman Islands into a tax haven?
Some smart lawyers who'd been around in the area, they'd made a fortune in Bahamas, turning that into a tax haven, saw Cayman as a place that was ripe to turn into another tax haven. So they came there and they came to the government and they said, look, we can make you a lot of money if you let us write the laws that's going to enable us to turn this island into a tax haven. So what does that mean? What sort of laws? Well, that means the laws to register offshore corporations, to register trusts, to register offshore banks. A whole raft of legislation was kind of grafted onto the Cayman Islands from these lawyers who'd had experience of doing it in places like Bahamas, like I said. And the Cayman Islands just happened to be ready and ripe for it.
Well, let's look at how these offshore havens, like the Cayman Islands, actually work and how multinational companies operate there. You have described going to the Cayman Islands to look at the corporate registry. Now, people in the United States, reporters, investigators, are used to being able to figure out who owns a corporation. There are registries with real information. What do you find in the Caymans when you go to look for information about a corporation?
Well, it's an interesting story. You turn up at a sort of government office called the registry for the island, where everyone's registered, all the people who live there, births and deaths and marriages. And there's also a little office where all the companies are registered. In Cayman, companies are like people. There's more companies than there are people anyway. And their companies are very important to them. They bring in an enormous amount of revenue. So you go in and you to the company registry office. And your hopes are high. You think, here I am. I'm going to find out about some Cayman company. And you fill in your form with the name of the company. You hand over your 50 Cayman dollars. Put the name of the company in, maybe Bronco Investments Limited, something like that. And you wait, and you see some people scurrying around in the background, picking out things out of files. Then you get handed a piece of paper, and it tells you really no more than you went in with the first place. It tells you the name of the company, the date it was set up, where the registered office is, and that's it. And also whether the company is active or whether it's been closed down. And that's all the information you get.
Do companies there even have an office, or are many simply a mail drop?
They don't have an office at all. They register with law firms. In the old days, each and every company that was registered at a law firm would have the old brass plaque up outside the front door of the law office. There would be Bronco Investments Limited. These days, because there are so many companies in Cayman, it's all computerized. You go into the lobby of the law firm, there's a computer screen, it's got the letters A through to Z, and you touch on the letter you want to check companies under, and up come 100 companies on the letter C, which is only like a small proportion of all the companies beginning with C.
So that's what a Cayman company is. It's literally an electronic listing in a law firm.
It's an electronic listing in a law firm. And you can't get any further than that.
Now, you describe how multinational corporations use offshore networks of interlocking companies, many of them housed in offshore havens, to minimize their taxes and maximize their profits. Give us an example of how this works. You for example, cite British Petroleum, and it has an associated company called Cayman 97. How does it use that company to maximize its profits?
Yeah, I mean, BP is one of the world's largest oil companies, exploration and production of oil. Now, it happens to have a lot of companies offshore, one of which is a company called Cayman's 97. Now, this company will hold interests in parts of the BP empire across the world. For example, oil rigs in off the coast of Nigeria, for example, or pipelines running through Russia. It will hold interest in those. It will hold interests in perhaps in parts of the business in Europe as well. But the point is that this offshore company is the place where all the profits from those businesses on the ground in Russia, in Nigeria, in Europe, they all accrue back to this one offshore company. The idea is that you're keeping the money away from the onshore world of nation states, as I like to call it. You're drawing it away, you're pooling it away and taking it into this offshore company. You're bringing it all together. You're accumulating all your capital into one place where you're allowed to do it and where there won't be people prying on you, where you don't have to release any information, where you don't have to release any accounts. You're pulling all this money together. We're talking about millions, hundreds of millions here. Now, when you have this money in this nice offshore pot, you can, well, you're not paying any tax on it by keeping it in Cayman. The objective for any company that's working offshore and onshore in the way I've described is that you produce your product, you manufacture your product, you distribute your product in a country, wherever it is across the world. But all the financial capital aspects of that, all the profit side of that, has to be taken back to the offshore corporation and preserved there, because then no one can touch it.
No one made heavier use of the Cayman Islands than Enron. Don't try and take us through all the details of Enron's machinations, but is there anything about their experience in particular that tells us, that reveals something about Cayman's role in the international economy?
Yeah. I mean, Enron is a textbook example. I mean, there in Cayman, they had 700 subsidiaries in Cayman and several hundred others in other tax havens across the world. Now, there were two things going on here. One of those, the main reasons for all these offshore tax haven incorporations was for tax. I mean, between 1996 and 2000, Enron was making billions and had only paid $17 million in those 4 years of tax. So these offshore companies were integral to how Enron structured itself across the world so that it paid the least tax. That's for tax reasons. And it was not the only company in that period to be paying that small amount of tax on the profits it was making. Now, what was going on at Enron, and this has happened in other companies like Global Crossing, for example, was that the offshore companies were set up to hide the losses of business, essentially. Business was going wrong. Enron was not the wonderfully valuable company that the public saw, really. What was behind the wonderfully high share price up in the late 90s was a company that was losing money big time on some really bad investments that it made. So what they did at Enron was to incorporate companies in Cayman in which to hide the losses that they were making. I mean, it's quite complicated because what they were doing was setting up companies to act as an insurance against the losses that they were making. So they were kind of spreading their risk into these offshore companies. Now, typically, if this was a legitimate operation, you'd have a third party who would take the risk, a third party who would hedge against any potential losses that you made or that you would make. In Enron's case, these were its own companies that it was setting up offshore. Now, the flexibility and freedom and secrecy that Cayman allowed Enron in the setting up of these companies to hide the losses, which it shouldn't have been doing, I mean, that was against the law. It was crossing the line of accounting legitimacy there. Only Cayman could give them that kind of freedom. Well, and other tax havens, but let's just say Cayman as the representative example here. And it's these offshore subsidiaries that in the end, they brought about the collapse. These were the secret parts of the Enron empire, which had been set up to kind of get Enron out of its troubles. But it caught up with them, and they ended up causing Enron to implode.
My guest is William Britton Catlin. His book is Offshore, The Dark Side of the Global Economy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Speaking with William Britton Catlin, his book is Offshore, The Dark Side of the Global Economy. In the 1990s, several Western nations and some international economic institutions made noises about cracking down on the use of offshore tax havens. What was happening?
Well, the world in the 1990s was alight with capital being suddenly liberated from the shackles that it had been held in, for example, in Russia and other parts of the Soviet bloc, and capital was flowing all over the world like it had never done before. And a lot of this money was going into Russia. Russia was going to be the great revolution, turning a backward socialist bloc country into a new, beautiful market economy. So there was a lot of money flowing around, but a lot of this investment in Russia from the IMF and from Western corporations, all this money going into Russia, as soon as it was getting there, the Russians themselves were taking it out. They were taking it off to offshore tax havens. Now, what happened was, to cut a long story short, that this money that was coming out of Russia. Russia was essentially being asset-stripped. The oligarchs were taking the money out, shoving it into their offshore companies. You needed to bank this money somewhere. Now, the best place to bank dirty money is in the most respectable banks that you can find. And this is what happened with a lot of Russian dirty money, is it found itself in American bank accounts in America. Now, when that came out with the Bank of New York, where it was discovered that millions of dollars of money had come from all sorts of questionable sources in Russia and was in American bank accounts, people got pretty alarmed about what had happened with this great explosion of capital across the world.
And they began cracking down on offshore tax havens?
Well, I guess what they saw was the dark side of the global financial system. The global financial system was hailed in the 90s as this great mechanism by which capital from one part of the world could go off to another part of the world and foreign investment could be made, and you know, the whole world would trundle along in a really fluid liberal market economy kind of way. Now, when you discover that in fact a lot of this money is being dirty money from mafia money or money that's come out from asset stripping institutions in Russia, for example, that, in other words, it's money that has been made illegitimately. When you discover that this money is in a bank account in New York and it's on, you know, your shores, you kind of see that this system, this international financial system, has gone wrong. Not only that, what was happening in Russia, the economy collapsed, and before that the economy had collapsed in Asia and before that in Latin America. And what the IMF found at each and every turn was that offshore tax havens and offshore banks had been responsible for covering up the huge debts that these countries had. These countries had spent beyond their means. Money was pouring in from Western banks to build up these emerging market economies. And there was a bubble. And when things started to go wrong, the losses become self-evident. And the losses were parked away in offshore tax havens. No one knew they were there. So when it was suddenly revealed that all this debt to these offshore banks, then economies fall apart. So what I'm saying is that this global financial system at the end of the 90s was almost tripping itself up with these offshore networks, which were hiding the way that money was really being worked across the global economy. It wasn't so fluid and so liquid and so transparent as perhaps the people who were really pushing for global capitalism at the time had fought.
So in June of 2000, what was then the G7 generated, in effect, a list of 15 money laundering havens, which they wanted to crack down on. And then in the wake of the September 11th attacks in 2001, there was enormous concern with international terrorism and the way it could use banking secrecy to hide its the financing of its own activities. When all of this happened, what was the effect on the Cayman Islands? Was the party over?
Yeah, they thought it was over. It was a really, very poor time for them. And I was over there in 2003, and they were really getting worried because they had the effect of the blacklists of 2000, as you said, where they were basically told to clear up, or the G8 countries weren't going to do business with them anymore, effectively making them ostracized in the global economy, which would have been pretty devastating. And then, of course, the focus following 9/11, when the focus was on tracking down terrorist financing, and obviously offshore jurisdictions became the focus in that. There were other measures as well that were European specific about Cayman, because it's a British dependent territory, having to release information about savers, about the financial information of people from the European Union who were saving money in the Cayman Islands. The Cayman authorities were going to have to give up that information to tax authorities in Europe. So you can see the whole pack of cards that they'd built up around their tax haven business looked as though it was going to fall down. So they I think, by and large, it wasn't just Cayman, though. And I suppose this is where it, you know, this was happening to all the offshore jurisdictions. They all had to kind of be much more careful about who they were doing business with, the transparency of corporations, the governance. There was a lot of kind of know your customer. It's more people's attitude to offshore tax havens that's changed rather than what's changed in reality. I think corporations and wealthy people are going to be less kind of keen to extol the virtues of offshore this and offshore that in these days. It's more of a kind of language thing. Sure, they've actually had to do open their books to tax investigators in Cayman more than they've ever had to before. Yes, money has gone off. It's gone off to places like Singapore and Hong Kong and the Bahamas. Cayman is a UK-dependent territory. It's, but in that sense, part of the European Union, weirdly. So if you send your money off to somewhere outside the European Union, which is what's been happening in Cayman, you can get round it. You can keep the same kind of secrecy again. And the offshore world is like that. It's a mutating, changing world. Sometimes you have places where there's a lot of surveillance, a lot of investigation of the bad things that are going on there with capital. Other places are left alone. And there's a lot of these places around. There's like 73 tax havens.
Well, William Britton Catlin, thanks so much for spending that time with us.
Thank you very much indeed. I enjoyed it.
Writer and BBC producer William Britton Catlin. His new book is Offshore, The Dark Side of the Global Economy. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, which include Everything You've Been Taught Is Wrong by James Lowen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants both to promote international understanding and address the root causes of global poverty. Online at Hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we'll talk with Martin Moran. As a young teenager, he was sexually abused by a former counselor at a Catholic boys' camp. As an adult, Moran went to visit the man at a convalescent home. He'll tell us what happened when they met again. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. 3 years ago, my guest actor Martin Moran tracked down and confronted the older man who had sexually abused him for 3 years when he was an adolescent. This encounter at the age of 42 provides the opening for Moran's book, The Tricky Part. The book explores the impact the abuse had on Moran's life. The Tricky Part is also a one-man play, which Moran is currently performing in Seattle. The book and play are full of unsettling complexity, as his rage at his abuser, whom he calls Bob, is mixed with his own sense of guilt for his role in the experience. Ben Brantley of the New York Times wrote, "What gives The Tricky Part its disturbing immediacy is Mr. Moran's gift for summoning the confused boy he was with exact sensory detail. This note for parents, some of the material in this interview may not be appropriate for children. You were 12 when this first happened. Tell us where you were in relation to puberty, in relation to sexual awareness generally.
Well, part of what feels so huge and mythic to me about what happened in the story was that I was literally on the cusp. I didn't quite know I was on the cusp of puberty, but I found out that night when he first seduced me. I was 12 years, 3 months, and 9 days old, as I remember so clearly and state in the book. And what happened that night was that I had my first experience, my first orgasm, as well as my first experience of anything sexual. And so that's, I think, part of why the collision felt so extreme for many, many reasons, being a Catholic kid and a naive altar boy. That was my very first experience of any kind.
How did this first encounter occur?
Well, there were several factors. I mean, I had first met this gentleman at a Catholic boys' camp called Camp St. Malo, which is was a beautiful camp outside of Denver, a Catholic boys' camp, and most of the counselors there were or were thinking about becoming seminarians. And I always assumed in one way or another this guy was a kind of seminarian because he was the head priest's assistant. And I was 10 at that time. And it was 2 years later, when I was 12 years old, that a neighborhood buddy of mine, George, sort of pudgy paperboy, a fellow paperboy, said, "Hey, remember that guy from Camp St. Malo? He's starting a camp of his own up on a ranch. You want to go?" And I was like, wow, a ranch. And one thing led to another, and I went that following weekend and sort of knew, and my parents sort of knew who this guy was because he'd worked at this reputable camp. And that evening, after a day of milking cows and learning to drive a tractor and, you know, just an incredible afternoon and evening on the ranch, that night he pulled me into his sleeping bag, and thus it occurred.
Did you know what was happening?
Yes and no. I mean, to have somebody touch you and you've never experienced it before was, you know, it was horrifying and thrilling and pleasurable. It was like, I knew it was a crime. I knew it was wrong. And I also couldn't deny the fact that it was this enormous awakening.
After that weekend, I mean, you were away with just your friend George and this mm-hmm. man, Bob, who was really clearing land and getting this camp together. He drives you home for the weekend, and all these things are swirling through your head. Did you think then about telling an adult, your parents, at any point?
You know, oddly or not oddly, I absolutely did not. Honestly, it was as though from that moment, those events were utterly like a fractured compartment of myself, tucked down deep inside, because I think, too, this is part of what grips you so much. I had an instant sense of being complicitous, that I allowed it to happen. Any other good boy, any other good person, any other strong person would have said, "Stop, stop, what are you doing?" But I didn't. I allowed, and that made me feel deeply, from the second it happened, complicitous. And that complicity sealed my silence. And always, each time he contacted me, there was this wrestling match of, I cannot return, I cannot do this. But it felt almost inevitable that my body, my feet took me that way. He was the only one who knew my secret. And he, being the only human being who knew my secret, it was the only place I found a few moments of relief, of what felt, in a sense, like forgiveness.
You never initiated any of these contacts with him?
I think as time went on, I did, yes. I remember a long period of time, for instance, where we weren't in contact. By that, I mean maybe 3 months had gone by. And there was a sense of missing him, of, you know, missing this guy who knew the secret. And there were moments, too. One time my mini bike was stolen, as crazy as this sounds, and I was absolutely devastated. It was a lot of paper route money, and I'd lost my mini bike had been taken. And my father, it's because my father had taken it down the street, God bless him, and, you know, and left it out front. And I was beside myself. And you know who I called? I called him, Bob, the man. And I said, "I'm devastated, I'm angry," and talked to him about it. And I remember thinking, I'm calling this guy to discuss with him this huge pain I'm having about my lost mini bike. And I remember we ended the conversation with him saying, you know, maybe somebody else in the universe needed that bike more than you, and You've got to trust that God has reasons for things. And you know what's important? You've got to forgive your father for taking your bike down the street. And that was a kind of conversation I had with him. So by way of telling you that this was deeply complex, it's not like the guy was a complete monster. He was also someone in whom, with whom I was in relation of some sort, as crazy as that may sound.
As these encounters continued, did you get to know other boys that he might have molested?
There were two in particular who were my same age and my same build, in fact. You know, there was a kind of, at one point, I as I'm reflecting on it, I say, I had this sense that we were a group, this little kind of blue-eyed, blonde-haired bordello of some sort of his. That being said, that's the 45-year-old me talking. At that time, there was, a subconscious awareness that this was going on with these other boys. But I did not witness it at that time, and I didn't, you know, it was not something we partook in together. There was one day, I mentioned this, where there was an incident where we were making breakfast, this guy and I, this fella that was my same age, a boy, and Bob called him up to the bedroom. And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and I knew, and off he went. And, 20 minutes later, he was back, and we continued making breakfast, and then Bob called my name. And he looked at me, and we were sitting there frying bacon, and he said, and he just, this is a 13-year-old kid, and he looked at me, and he said, you know, I'll continue to fry the bacon, you go get in the frying pan. So that was a way of, and he laughed. And there was a moment of us laughing. I mean, it was just, how were we in this absurd secret situation? And it was the closest moment to saying something out loud, and it was couched in a witty joke by a 13-year-old boy.
You're gay. I'm wondering, did you and Bob ever talk about homosexuality?
Yes, in this context, that I was, as I got a little bit older, as I was 13 and a half, 14, early 14 year, 14 in some months, I had this great sense, I'm moving toward manhood. And I'm really on a bad path. I'm really, really screwing up here. I'm involved with this guy. I know it's illicit and secret and criminal. And again, him being the guy who knew my secret, I finally one day found the courage to ask him. I said, I am terrified that I'm going to turn out to be homosexual. And in that Catholic world, in that Catholic context, I was terrified of that. I was terrified of being damned for being gay, for being homosexual. And I asked him. And he said, oh, no, that's, you're not going to be. And I said, but look at us, what? And he said, no, we're not like that. We love each other. And homosexuals are people who have no love. But we love each other, we care about each other, and that's different. So, to say the least, I don't know where that twisted thinking came from, that, the guy was a sick pedophile. And in addition, he was a homophobe. And it took me many years to pull the pieces apart and understand that my authentic sense of self had to do with being a gay man, that I came into the world that way. And that, I think, what happened with Bob, though it had dollops of being a clue to who I might be, really, more than anything, robbed me of whatever peaceful steps toward an authentic sexual self I would have had in those adolescent years. It took me many years into my early 20s, mid-20s, before I came to any sort of peace about being gay.
This the contact with Bob went on for 3 years. How did it finally come to an end?
It finally came to an end primarily because I became more and more deeply terrified that he would get into trouble. As I had an awareness there were other boys. I had an awareness that I just had this instinctual sense, this guy's going to get into trouble. In addition to that, I had a profound sense. I was leaving grade school to go into an all-boys Catholic Jesuit high school where my father had gone, my grandfather, my cousins, my uncles. It was time now. I have got to become a man. I've got to grow up and be a good person. My sense was that if I had any hope at extricating myself from this dark path I'd gone down, that I had to break off all contact with this man. So I actually confronted him and said, I don't ever want to see you again. I'm ashamed of everything that happened between us. And I was 15 years old on that night. I drove up there to see him, and I did not see him again for 30 years. When I was 42, and he was 60, and I found him again in a veterans hospital in Los Angeles.
My guest is Martin Moran. His book and play, The Tricky Part, deal with his experiences of being sexually abused as a child. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martin Moran. He's written a book and performs a play called The Tricky Part. It deals with him coming to terms with the damage he suffered from a 3-year abusive relationship with a sexual predator as a child. Well, Martin Moran, after you ended the relationship with this man, Bob, you were always a good student and were a good student for a while, but there came a point at which the emotional damage just really caught up with you. How did this present itself?
Well, it presented itself essentially as the wish to die, to get out of here. I mean, I can remember very rationally sitting there at my, you know, my little high school desk and my, or my desk in my room and thinking, you know, there are good things in the world. God made beautiful things, those bushes, that tree, those birds. But I am not of the natural world. Something went wrong. I am a mistake. And it was a very rational thought. As a mistake, I must be erased, and I must have the courage to erase the mistake. And it was this, you know, this profound feeling that my one way out, the one thing that was the responsible thing to do, was to kill myself.
There's a remarkable moment in the book where you describe a way you found of, I think you describe it as seeing a source of light and moving toward the light. And it came when you and your family were watching, I think, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Yes, I look back at that as the first hints. There was Gene Wilder and the gang singing on the television, and there was that oompa boompa doobity day, whatever that song was. And I started singing in the kitchen at the top of my lungs, and I remember my sister with her raggedy blonde hair looking up at me and saying, "God, you've got a loud voice." And there was something, as I look back, about the notion of voice and the notion of singing and music. And for some reason, it was as though that was a clue, this huge clue. And not a month later, I found myself literally following my feet, following my body, to signing up for an audition for a musical at George Washington Public High School, where I went to school in Denver. And there was this wonderful theater program there. And that was the beginning of, as you say, a kind of light.
You then went through a lot of high school plays, went to college. Mm-hmm. And did performing, found you were good at it, got voice training, and grew up, became a gay man with a stable long-term relationship with your mate Henry.
Yes.
But you've said, and you write in the book, that the legacy of this abusive relationship you had in a child kept reasserting itself in the way you thought about and pursued sex.
Yeah.
What was happening?
Essentially, what was happening was I found that I was undeniably, uncontrollably sexually compulsive, that I sought out sex that was secret and dangerous and apart from what I considered to be my public self, my good self, the self that Henry knew. And I did not put this together with what happened when I was a kid for a long time. It took me a long time to sort of connect the dots. That I was, in a sense, gripped by and repeating a thing that had entered my nervous system, my psyche, as a young boy. And ultimately, I was able to share this with Henry and get help. And it took a long, long time. I was well into my mid and late 30s before I began to put the pieces together.
You go through a lot of therapy and come to terms with a lot of this, and eventually, I mean, a climactic moment of your book, I'm sure of your life, is when you track down Bob, the man who abused you as a young adolescent, mm-hmm. who's now old and feeble in a veterans hospital.
Yeah.
Tell us about that encounter. I mean, were you there to exact retribution, to express your rage? What happened?
Well, the abiding feeling I had at that time was I needed to lay eyes on the evidence. I needed to look into the face of the man who, for all these years, in one way or another, had gripped me, or I thought he'd gripped me, that he had a grip on my life because of the wickedness and badness I felt of what happened when I was a boy. And it's hard to describe the complexity, the many, many feelings that I experienced in facing him. There was a way in which, though, it was kind of very calm. Here was this wizened old man sitting in a wheelchair. Here I was, a 42-year-old guy who'd finally tracked him down. And the first instant feeling I had was that this man who lived inside of me, who I thought lived inside of me as a myth, as a gigantic mountain, shrunk to the size of a wizened little human being, gray-haired and slumped and pathetic. And I said the things I felt I had to say. I did not feel rage in that moment. I went through many times in my life where I felt a kind of rage and fantasized strangling him or I don't know what, smacking him. But all I could say was there was this little human being and here I was. And I said what I had to say. You know, Bob, do you realize how much I've thought about you? How much I've been gripped by what happened? And what happened that was the most surprising to me was that I saw in some profound kind of way how ultimately he was beside the point. That I had to, that forgiveness had so deeply to do with me. I once heard a guy say that he thought the truest definition of forgiveness was a complete letting go of all hope of having had a different or a better past. And I thought, in 10 years he's going to be 70 or dead, and I'm going to be 50 and 60. How long am I going to have this sense that this man has a grip on me? And the gift of that day was that I realized more than anything, I'd come there to put my arm around the 12-year-old and forgive myself.
The most important thing about the encounter may be, of course, what you came to terms with, but I think we're also interested in what, I mean, did he ever confront the gravity of what he had done? I mean, the kind of damage it does to take a kid who is 12 and put him through what he did.
Well, this is a sticky point because that's probably, one of the things I deeply wanted was to see in his eyes a complete and utter acknowledgement of the wrong. But I have to say that never really occurred. He never really looked me square in the eye and said, that was absolutely unforgivable and wrong and a violation of your very being. He had a moment in there where he said, I guess on the one hand, you see, I wanted to build you up, but on the other, I was tearing you down. And I'm sorry you went through all of this. That's the closest he got to a genuine apology. Not a full acknowledgement, not a full emotional present human being saying to you, I wronged you.
My guest is Martin Moran. His book and play are called The Tricky Part. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martin Moran. His book, The Tricky Part, is also a one-man play at which he deals with the consequences of 3 years of abuse he suffered as a child at the hands of a man who'd been a camp counselor. When did your parents learn about the abuse you suffered, and how did they react?
There was a way in which the story remained hidden for a long time, like locked away inside of me, inside of my body and being, and there was a way in which by tiny dribs and drabs over the years, it began to be revealed My father, I can remember having a slight awareness of it in my early college years when I was a freshman or my first year or two at Stanford. There was a time in which he and I spoke, and he mentioned something about it, and I realized that only then that I had said something to my oldest sister, for instance, about, you know, a little bit about the story, and she had mentioned something to my dad, and so my dad asked me a question, you know, oh, that was it. What happened with that guy? And, you know, he made some veiled reference. Oh, that's the guy who made you gay or something. And that was his take on it at that point. That was the end of the discussion. Mom, nothing for years. Then as the years went by, in the same way I began to scribble the story and feel this need to make sense of it and write about it, slowly bits and pieces of it began to be revealed. I would say my late 20s, my early 30s, a few details came in, you know, here and there. And there was an awareness, I think, that that guy, Bob, had been in trouble or arrested at some point. But there was never talk about it in my house. I don't remember ever actually seeing it in the newspaper when I was growing up. But to tell you the truth, the whole shebang didn't hit the table and really get discussed until, lo and behold, here I am doing a play about it, start developing this play about 2.5 years ago with my director, my friend the director, Seth Barish. And by virtue of doing the play, then things really began to be talked about, how long it went on, what really happened. So it was a lifelong revelation for them. I think there was a sense of pain, of culpability, of how did we let this happen? There were my discussions with them of, I don't blame you, you know, and they were in the middle of a divorce and lots was going on. And there's been a lot of pain around it for them. Mom has chosen to see the play, read the book, talk through with me. My father passed away recently, just a couple of weeks ago. He was very proud that I was writing it, I think, and very proud that the play existed, but he did not in any way, shape, or form want to read it or see it. It was too much for him.
You bring a very, as you say, a complex and nuanced view of this abuse you suffered, which you say was also a relationship of types. And your book and your play bring all that complexity. And I wonder if some audiences or some activists criticize you for humanizing a child molester.
Yes. Yeah. It's uncomfortable as hell, isn't it? To like look at somebody and say, well, I'm trying to say that, yeah, the experience I had was that at one point in the encounter with this guy who violated me when I was a kid, at one point I put my hand on his shoulder and say to him, well, I don't hate you, you know, and I don't understand exactly why I did that in that moment. That's what I genuinely felt. And I don't understand totally why the book and the play came out the way it did, not as a rant, but as an inquiry into the complexity of this. But yes, to answer your question, I've had a fair amount of people come up and say, I don't understand what you're talking about. Why aren't you more angry? Why aren't you, you're in denial. You're not angry enough. And all I can say to them is, I have been angry. I probably will be angry again. But anger and blame was not yielding understanding for me. The anger and blame felt like a wall to me.
We've learned that the guy who molested you, Bob, had two convictions for this, for which he served really very little time. I think 4 months in one case and was virtually none in a second case. Did you ever contact or did you ever speak to other victims of his?
Recently I did. Last summer I performed the play in Denver. And at that time, I reconnected with a young man, a man who I knew back then, when I was a boy. And I reconnected with him last summer. He came to see my play. And we saw each other afterwards, and he threw his arms around me and began to tell me of his experiences with the same man. And it was, you know, it was hard, and it was amazing, and it was, and his experience, of course, was distinct from mine. We each had very separate kind of experience with Bob. And one of the things that happened with him was that he said that when he read the article about the play was when he first sat down with his family and said, I want to tell you something that happened to me 30-something years ago. And he's married with two kids. And he began to be able to talk about what happened so many years ago.
Do you find that over time you gather new insights into the experience? Does your thinking about it continue to change?
All the time. I think probably it will be fluid and changing and until I die. It's been this. It's a book now. I mean, I look at the book. I still can't believe it exists. It's a play. It bore fruit. There's a way in which somehow my craft as an actor and this story that I thought of as so dark all came together, and I have the opportunity to do this for a while. I don't want to do it forever.
I was going to ask whether you worry about being defined by this experience and this book and this play.
I haven't worried about that, no, because I just basically have a sense of fate that I'm doing exactly what I'm meant to do in life right now. And, you know, you can worry about the perception or you can worry about, but I've in some ways never been happier, never been fuller. I just celebrated 20 years with my partner, Henry. I can pay this week's bills, thank God, because the Intiman Theater has hired me to play and do the play. And, you know, in November, I'll do the play at San Jose Rep, and it'll be over about mid-November, and then I feel like I'll be on to new adventures.
Well, Martin Moraine, thanks so much for speaking with us. We wish you success with the book and further healing.
Thank you, Dave. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you.
Writer and actor Martin Moraine. His book and one-man play are called The Tricky Part. Moraine is currently performing The Tricky Part in Seattle. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from TIAA Craft, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good. TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Over There, Stephen Bochco tells us about his new TV series. It follows a U.S. Army unit that arrives in Iraq for its first tour of duty. Bochco has won 10 Emmy Awards for his work on Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, and NYPD Blue. Join us for the next Fresh Air.